And I'll quickly provide an overview of the agenda. Today we're going to hear from four different agencies that I've asked to come in and give a brief overview of their committee, or their, I'm sorry, their agencies, and since they'll be coming in front of this committee on several occasions, to provide a little bit of background on what their agency missions are and what they're working on this session, and really focusing on their legislative agenda. So we have the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board will be coming up first. We'll be also hearing from the Department of Human Services, from the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and also from the Department of Environmental Quality, this time the Air Division. We heard from the water folks and a broader overview on Friday. So first I will ask Tom Beiler, who's director for the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, and he's going to provide an overview on the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, which, for those of you who aren't aware, but I'm sure most of you are, the Measure 66, part of our lottery funds, goes to fund this program. Before we get started, I will, just a reminder to all the committee members, actually, this is the last day that we will be in this hearing room. On Wednesday, starting January 24th, and for that next week, we will be meeting in Hearing Room A, and it'll be a joint hearing with the House Revenue Committee on the biofuels package. So please make sure and check your agenda. And then starting January 31st, we are going to be moving to Hearing Room C. And again, hopefully your staff will remind you, and if you show up here, maybe we'll put a note and say, go to Hearing Room C. But this will be the last day we'll actually be in this hearing room. Thank you. Welcome, Tom.
Well, thank you, Chair Dingfelder. For the record, my name is Tom Beiler. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. And you'll be receiving some handouts, two handouts in particular. One is a one-pager that we're using to the kind of nutshell about OWEB. Talks about our agency and our board and what we do, as well as our legislative priorities. And also, I'll have before you a multi-page document that I'll be speaking from generally. I'm not going to be going through this verbatim in the interest of time. I know you have a full agenda today, and I want to kind of take a high-level overview of not only the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, but I want to give you a sense of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, as we are a big player within the context of the Oregon Plan and the family of agencies, state agencies, and local groups that are involved with that. With that, as I go through my presentation, I'll refer you to certain slides where there might be some pertinent information that I'd like you to take a look at. But otherwise, let's start with an overview of OWEB. OWEB, in its core function with the Watershed Enhancement Board, is that we are a grant program. And I say that, and I have to smile to myself a little bit, because one of the things that I constantly think about is that I hope that I leave you today thinking that OWEB is more than just a grant program. While that is what we do in terms of function, what we represent is something much more important to Oregonians across the state. Our grant program symbolizes a new way of doing business with respect to natural resources management. It is added value to the system of state agencies and their programs, which provide fundamental resources and structure to the management of natural resources. We provide added value. And we do so by funding voluntary restoration projects, principally on private lands, in a voluntary manner, that improve water quality and that improve habitat for fish and wildlife. It's this voluntary cooperative conservation that is the heart of what we do. Our other role within the state government is to provide coordination of monitoring relative to the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, as well as reporting on the progress that the state is making with respect to the Oregon Plan. In terms of the voluntary cooperative conservation, the grant program that we administer, it's based on a very key principle, and that is that we invest in a strong local grassroots organizational structure to make this program work. Again, it's premised on the notion that we are successful if landowners are doing this work voluntarily, that they want to do this work, that they become empowered and bought into this process and become stewards of their watersheds through our incentives offered through our grant program. the way we access these landowners primarily is through local watershed councils, which reflect a broad spectrum of local communities. These are volunteer organizations that have coordinators that that provide their leadership, as well as soil and water conservation districts, which are local governmental units that have strong ties with local agricultural interests. Between the councils and the districts, they account for the vast majority of the grants that we receive. They're the folks who do the legwork. They're the ones who establish the relationships with the landowners to put the projects on the ground. They're the ones who write the grants and work with our agency to receive the monies and administer the grants and implement the grants. In terms of the value that this program brings, is that it really is about improving the quality of life for Oregonians. Oregonians around the state value the quality of life, and part of the quality of life that they value are the natural resources that we all enjoy. And this program allows local communities and landowners to take a very active role in controlling the fate of their backyards. So it thereby empowers those folks to take a very active role in doing that work. What it also does is it builds and strengthens partnerships. And that's very important also in the natural resources arena, where there are times when you'll read headlines about natural resources issues being sometimes controversial and creating a lot of conflict between communities, perhaps between communities and government. This program offers an opportunity for not only OWEB staff, but other state agencies who we rely on heavily for technical assistance, to work with landowners in different communities across the state to build bridges and build partnerships and to do things that everyone feels good about. That helps build trust between the state government and state government employees and local landowners and local communities. And it's a very powerful thing to witness firsthand. I thought I might take a second just to describe for, I know some of you are very familiar with our program, and others this may be a first introduction. I thought I'd just take a second to describe how our projects work. We have a wide array of projects, but I'll just give you an example of kind of an east side, west side examples in general terms. On the west side, you might have a landowner who lives on a property and road that accesses his house crosses a stream that has historically been salmon habitat. That road has a culvert the road crosses the stream. There's a culvert that goes under the road that lets water pass through there. Let's just say that culvert was put in decades ago and it's in disrepair, and fish cannot get past that culvert up into historic habitat. It's been that case for a long, long time. The local watershed council in that area assesses the ecological needs of that basin and recognizes that stream had historical value for fish, and that if that culvert were replaced, you would open up significant habitat for salmon. Under this process, the watershed council would approach the landowner, and if the landowner wanted to, there's certainly no arm twisting here, but if the landowner wanted to, they could work together where the council would write a grant to OWEB. OWEB would fund the work to be done, and what you would end up with is a new culvert with fish passage, and in some cases the value to the private landowner is more than just the knowledge that you're helping habitat, but it could actually protect the road. In some cases those culverts are old and they get stopped up, they have maintenance issues, they could back up water, create in high water periods of time could create damage to that private road. So there's opportunities, significant opportunities for win-win situations. An example on the east side of the mountains is through irrigation is such a big part of the east side. And in many parts of the east side, there are canal systems that deliver water to agricultural purposes. Through OWEB grants, districts and local agricultural producers are able to pipe their diversions, which reduces loss of flow through canals, creates a more reliable delivery system for the ag producer, and puts more water in the stream to protect water quality and fit flows for fish. So with that, One distinction that you'll find with OWEB and most of the other agencies that we partner with is that some of these other agencies that will appear before you have been around for decades. OWEB is yet to be around for a decade. We started in 1999, and we were created by the state legislature in response to ballot measure 66. And ballot measure 66 was passed by Oregon voters, 67% of Oregon voters, in 1998, and it dedicated 15% of lottery funds to two purposes, two central purposes. One was to state parks, the other was to watershed restoration and improvement. Those two purposes are split in half. And OWEB was created by the legislature to administer the 7.5% for watershed restoration purposes, and that is our key function. I would add two pieces of information about Measure 66 that are constantly on my mind. One is that this is constitutional dedication, mind you. One is that the Constitution also directs that at least 65% of those revenues, those lottery revenues, are to go to what are called capital purposes. Well, in our world, capital purposes mean on-the-ground restoration projects, improving the habitat and improving water quality. The remainder of those funds can go towards complementary activities that help make those capital projects, those on-the-ground restoration projects, effective. So, for example, we're talking about projects such as, or uses such as technical assistance, the engineering, the design work. We're talking about monitoring so that we can track our progress over time. We're talking about support for the local groups that help move these projects forward. So that blend of capital and non-capital dollars is a very important part of what we do. And something that we are striving to find the right balance of. The last point on ballot measure 66 that makes working at OWEB unique is that ballot measure 66 has a 15-year window. It will terminate in 2014 unless, in November of 2014, the voters decide to pass it again. It will, part of that measure requires that it go up for a vote again. So we're about halfway through our 15-year period, and I can tell you that it changes the way we think and at OWEB. We are constantly striving to maximize our potential with the revenues that we have available. We're constantly looking for doing the best we can do with the resources that we have. We know that there's going to be an accounting in 2014, and we want to be able to show that this experiment in local empowerment and in cooperative conservation is something that's working. I feel strongly that it is working. We have a long way to go, but there are many indicators that it's a very powerful mechanism to do work with respect to natural resources. I'll mention just briefly our board, and it's an important point I want to make because our board is nearly as large as our staff. We have a 17-member board. And what's important about our board is that it's integrated with board members from other state natural resources agencies. We have a board member from the Board of Agriculture, the Board of Forestry, the Water Resources Commission, the Environmental Quality Commission, and the Fish and Wildlife Commission. We also have board members, non-voting board members, who represent federal agencies. We have members from the public at large. We have a tribal representative. We have a very wide and diverse group of folks interested in natural resources with different backgrounds and different disciplines with respect to natural resources, which is very important because our work really covers all the different agency program areas. We deal with water quality, we deal with fish, forest issues, ag issues, and it's very important to have that integration of what we do with those other agencies and their boards. I'd point you to page 6 of the slides. There, on that page, there are two pie charts, and I'll just want to walk you through those very briefly. The first one at the top, the main point I want to make there, that's a pie chart of the funding sources that we have available this biennium. And the main point there is to note that we're not solely funded by Measure 66 funds. We have had since the year 2000 federal dollars in the form of Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Funds. One remark I would make with respect to those federal dollars is that they're diminishing. In this biennium, we have 22%. In previous biennium, we had nearly a 50-50 split between the federal dollars and the lottery dollars. And I think that this is not the only agency that you'll hear concerns about diminishing federal funds in terms of how it affects their programs. The slide at the bottom is a shows the different types of grants that we have and the percentage of funding that we distribute for those grants. As I mentioned, we have our capital restoration grants as well as these non-capital grant types, technical assistance, assessment work, council support, and education and monitoring. What I wanted to point out to you, and this is the funding that we've distributed so far this biennium. What I want to point out to you here is that when you combine our capital grant types, restoration and acquisition, it represents 80% of the total, which is far exceeds the 65% that Measure 66 identifies. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. That means we're getting a lot of projects on the ground. But what it raises from our perspective and from the folks that we partner with is the concern that we have sufficient non-capital resources to support those other grant types. And I think as lottery revenue continues to increase over time, that will continue to be a big issue for us to achieve the right balance.
Mr. Beiler, we have a question from one of the panel members.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom, on page 6, that pie chart at the top where it talks about the Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Fund, that pie chart's for this current year. What's the projection of those federal dollars for the next biennium? I've heard everything from zero to...
Felder, Vice Chair Burley, that's a very good question, and I can speculate on that a bit for you. Let me start by saying that our proposed budget under the governor's recommended budget has estimated, based on past federal funds, looking back over since 2000, they estimated about $10 million of Pacific Coast Salmon Recovery Funds coming in for federal fiscal year 07, which we're expecting Congress to act on soon. The information that I have now is that budget will be passed through a continuing resolution. What that means, and there's some question about whether there will be earmarks or not on the federal funds. OWEB, or State of Oregon's share of these federal dollars, and these federal dollars go to the State of Washington, State of California, Idaho, Alaska, and Northwest tribes, and they're split up between those entities. Oregon's share in the previous fiscal year was $6.5 million, but there was an earmark of nearly about $2.4 million earmark on top of that we were not able to receive into our program, which left us with about $4 million. So under that scenario, we're looking at anywhere from $6.5 to $4 million coming in for this current fiscal federal year. And I can tell you that in the past, we had received, we'd averaged about $12 million a year.
Thank you. We have about 5 more minutes, so you may have to triage towards the end here.
All right. I will move quickly. I want to do one thing with respect to OWEB as a wrap-up. I'll point you to one on page 8, the bottom slide. I will not walk you through this because it will take too long. But it's a comparison between what we're doing in Oregon versus the state of Washington. What I want to underscore for you is that these represent probably the two states that are doing the most with respect to natural resources improvement, but we have two different philosophies in how we're doing it. Oregon is based on grassroots local infrastructure, whereas Washington is based on more centralized program. And as you look through that, we've spent a little bit less money. We're getting more projects out of it. We're reaching more people and landowners as a result of that. And then when you look at the second box below there, you can see that in terms of outputs, in terms of work that we're getting done on the ground, we're achieving at a very, very high level.
Mr. Beiler, I would be interested also if you added another line there to look at land acquisition, because I'd be curious to see where we rate with Washington, since that's part of OWEB's purview, correct? And
yes.
I don't know if you have those numbers about how much land has been acquired already or is projected, but that would be good information, I think, for this committee to have.
We can absolutely pull that information together. I think that may be embedded in those larger numbers of the habitat restoration number, but we can parse that out for you.
Thank you. Did you have a question?
Yes.
Representative Jensen?
Yes. Tom, can you tell me, does OWEB provide funds for removal from fish-bearing streams where the fill is at a point of making those streams non-fish-bearing?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Jensen, make sure I understand your question. Would we fund a dredging? Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
I don't know if we've ever funded a project like that, but I can certainly look into that, whether we've done that in the past.
I'm talking specifically about East Birch Creek and Umatilla County that you perhaps are familiar with.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I sitting here today, I'm not dredging that up in my mind right now, so to speak.
Well, maybe you can get back to Representative Jensen directly with that.
Thank you.
I'd like you to at least cover a little bit on the salmon watershed plan. That would
absolutely
be good for the committee to hear. Thanks.
And I'll be brief on this as well. The Oregon plan is less of a plan and more of a philosophy of governance that embodies, and I'll point you to page 11, where we have the four elements of the Oregon plan. This was born out of issues that arose in the early and mid-1990s where petitions to list salmon in the Northwest were pending, where there was litigation under the Clean Water Act regarding water bodies across the state, and the state's response was to put together the Oregon plan. It evolved over time and is now a statewide plan that's based on these four principles. One is that coordinated agency action is critical to do good work. The local voluntary cooperative conservation that OWEB does is another leg of the Oregon plan. That you need significant monitoring and reporting to be able to understand the progress that you're making and how effective you are, and being able to make adjustments over time based on what you're learning, and that you have good science to oversee that work. What's significant about the Oregon plan is that we have, in my view, is the coordination between the agencies. And on page 12, you'll see the different agencies that, this is not an exhaustive list, quite honestly, but it shows the, kind of the main agencies and their different programs that they work on. Many of these programs pre-existed the Oregon plan. And the bottom slide there shows the coordination structure that we have, where we have regular meetings to talk about the Oregon plan and issues that arise that face us all in a more formal manner than we had before. I think before the Oregon plan, a lot of the coordination between agencies was issue-driven. This has become more of an institutionalized coordination between agencies that otherwise would have separate missions. And that provides better services to the public and lets us do a better job in terms of our natural resources management. One piece that I would mention about the Oregon plan that is, we are focused very much on recovery of salmon species, and there's one part of the state where I think is going to be an interesting test case of the Oregon plan of Measure 66 and OWEB and what we've been trying to achieve here, and that is the North Coast with coastal coho. In the last 2 years, those fish, the federal government decided not to list that species, and we've been busy working with primarily the Fish and Wildlife Department has been working with a number of agencies in the governor's office on a conservation plan that will be completed in the next couple of months. OWEB will be a big part of implementing the priorities established in that plan, and the goal is to move those fish populations up to rebuild those levels of those fish populations so that they're sustainable over time, so that we're not just hovering at the precipice of a listing, but in fact we're moving those fish into populations that they could offer opportunities for sustainable commercial and recreational harvest. That's a big deal in terms of habitat restoration. It's a significant achievement in terms of the local communities there who I think would really benefit from being able to have that be a part of their local economy again as well. So there's much work ahead. We've made great progress. We have local involvement. Locals are invested in this work. We have better coordination among the agencies. The habitat and water quality is improving, but we still have a long way to go, and we need to keep focused on this. And I do appreciate the opportunity to kind of very briefly lay the foundation for the Oregon plan, because it really is the umbrella that covers a lot of the work that you're going to hear about from other agencies over the course of the next few months.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Beiler?
I just have a quick question, and it's about the thank you, Chair, about the local watershed councils. If I understand you correctly, they're oftentimes your eyes and ears on the ground. And I'm wondering, are those, do those exist in every county of the state? Are they set up through statute? Can you just explain a little bit more about how those are created?
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Cannon, they are set up by statute. They are voluntary units, essentially, that are designated by local government, whether it could be a municipality, it could be a county, and those local governments basically give the council their charter and become recognized through that. But beyond that, that is the only nexus that councils have to governmental organizations. They are often organized in a variety of different ways, but you often see them organized as 501c3 organizations. And they are designed to embody the breadth of the different interests in the community. So if a council is functioning well, it's going to have representatives at the table, volunteer representatives at the table for their meetings that represent the different types of interests in that community, whether it be ag, forestry, industry, you name it. It depends on the different basin that you're in. Their funding principally comes through OWEB, but they are working very hard in some areas, very successful in broadening their portfolio of funding sources. But that's a constant challenge, and it's been very difficult over the last 5 or 6 years just because of economic pressures that have affected the country nationally, in reality. These groups cover all four corners of the state. I think I wouldn't be wrong to say that they're in every county. We have 90 councils that cover, I would imagine, every district of every legislator in the state. And they have slightly different missions in terms of what they try to achieve. We do not direct them, but we do have expectations in terms of being productive. And the money that they receive through OWEB is through a competitive grant process, and we look very closely at the work that they achieve in the previous biennium before we make awards for the following biennium.
Thank you, Mr. Beiler.
Thank you. Any other questions? No. Thank you, Mr. Beiler. And I just wanted to say I just received the annual report. Or is it biannual report?
Biannual report, yes.
And I was going to say I want to make sure that every committee member gets a copy of that Oregon Plan update.
We have distributed, Chair Dingfelder, yes. Okay. Thank you.
May want to hold it up so folks know, since we get a lot of stuff in our inbox.
This was distributed on January 15th, hand-delivered by the director of OWEB into your inboxes, all the committee members with the natural resources interest. As well as the governor, and this is a report to the legislature. You are the committees that we are reporting to, and I'd be happy to talk with all of you in more detail. I will be setting up meetings with you to talk one-on-one, and would be happy to respond to any specific questions you have and to walk you through the details of that report if you're interested.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. It's actually, committee members, a very interesting report, and I would encourage you to look at it, especially to see what projects are going on in your own district. So now we will move on to Gail Shibley is here. She's the director of what's your official title? You'll have to say for the record, but she is with the Department of Human Services. And as Representative Jensen had asked about the drinking water program on Friday, I did say we were having Ms. Shipley coming in to talk today about the purview of the Department of Human Services and drinking water. And it is confusing, committee members, because there are shared responsibilities with the Department of Environmental Quality. So I'm hoping that Ms. Shipley could enlighten us on how they work closely with the Department of Environmental Quality and who has jurisdiction over what. I think you also have a bill in front of this committee, so you can maybe give us a little overview on that as well. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Gail Shibley. My title is Administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health in DHS's Public Health Division. There'll be a quiz on that later. I have to write on both sides of my business card sometimes. I very much appreciate the opportunity just to provide you some information overview about drinking water and about the legislative proposals that I am very hopeful you will be seeing and hearing and discussing and voting on over the next several weeks and months. I'm having a little bit of technical difficulty here. Not sure if... got this lovely PowerPoint. Let me also explain the other handouts that I believe you're receiving. One is just a little one-color snapshot, if you will, of the drinking water program and kind of the history of drinking water in the state. My PowerPoint won't be presenting that, but it's important information, so wanted to make sure that, that you had that available. Also, some of you had received this a few months ago as well, but we put together a little environmental public health snapshot and tried to make it as close as possible to your individual legislative districts. As you can imagine, district boundaries don't exactly fit with public health data collection boundaries, and so there is a rather important caveat down at the bottom on the second page, but it provides you some fairly real-time information about what's going on in your district compared to the state overall in terms of drinking water, radiation safety, cleanup of meth labs, lead poisoning, and food safety. And see, this is still searching. Let me see if I can catch up with it here. I believe you've got handouts here of this PowerPoint that. What I want to do is lay out how are we doing? How are we doing? What is the state of the state of Oregon's drinking water? And I've got some good news and some not so good news, and then maybe some more good news. The first is that drinking water is, you know, fairly essential. How many people here drink water? I'm guessing a number. It is rather interesting to note that in public health, 90% of the lengthening of the human lifespan is because of food, water, and other environmental gains. It's not the wowie zowie medical advances, as important as those have been. It is, in fact, very basic sanitation, cleanliness of drinking water. So where do we get it in Oregon? Well, tap water serves more than 3 million people, and those systems, there are larger systems, 25 and more, that are governed by the EPA. And
Ms. Shibley,
yeah,
we have the. Don't worry about. Okay. We have the handout, so if you just want to walk. And Representative Jensen has a question for you.
Thank you, Gail. In relationship to your beginning of the presentation here, you seem to be placing the emphasis on health as far as the drinking water is concerned, and the relationship. Water has to do with and contributes to health. Therefore, am I to assume that it is your department that should be responsible for providing fluoridation to all of the water systems in the state of Oregon?
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, you may note, let's see, I think I even have a PowerPoint slide here that how do we provide drinking water? And as we point out, a chain is as strong as its weakest link. But the chain really begins with the public water systems themselves. The public water systems provide the drinking water. Whether it has fluoride in it or not, that is up to the water systems to determine what water they provide. Under Oregon law, that's the way it's set up. It is, of course, the US EPA's responsibility to set minimum health standards, and it is state and county public health to assure those minimum health standards are met so that communities that do fluoridate water fluoridate it in a safe manner within US EPA health standards. But we do not fluoridate water. We don't provide the water. The 3,600 and some individual public water systems around the state of Oregon provide drinking water.
Follow up. I'm sure.
I'll let that go then. We're at the kind request.
Follow up.
Evil eyes of the of the chair.
Okay.
Okay. So Madam Chair, you asked about where public health fits and where drinking water fits. Drinking water is part of environmental public health. My office is responsible for virtually anything and everything having to do with environmental public health, from radiation safety, cleanup of meth labs, all the things that are there on that snapshot. And also food safety, inspecting restaurants, and we are part of a broader, more kind of medically focused, hospital focused public health division. I keep forgetting what the name is because sometimes it's division, sometimes it's not. But the public health division that includes epidemiology, WIC, family planning, school-based health centers, immunization, the state public health lab, and so on. All of that is housed within the Department of Human Services. So I am one piece. Drinking water is one piece of environmental public health. Environmental public health is one piece of public health. Public health is one piece of DHS, and we're all part of the house that Jack built. So what I do want to call your attention to, and it really is too bad that I can't seem to get this figured out.
Can we not
here.
Provide some technical assistance? This is why we are moving this room, by the way, because also the situation here is not great. But just to clarify for the committee, we had Department of Environmental Quality come in that oversees water quality in our streams, rivers, and the Department of Human Services, Ms. Shipley's shop, make sure that the drinking water quality is at certain standards. So there's some, I don't want to say overlap, but there is a little bit of overlap there. But it is very confusing, especially for the public. I get calls, people say, well, doesn't DEQ regulate this? So this is part of what we wanted you to help
right.
educate
I
the community
appreciate
about.
That very much, Madam Chair. In fact, it is confusing to a lot of folks, and it's been my experience just in the past several years that people, when they think of public health or health services, even the Health Services Committee, don't really think of drinking water. Natural resources and water committees, of course, often focus on surface water and groundwater and recreational uses of that water, not so much on the drinking of the water. And so we kind of fall between the cracks, no pun intended. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this.
Representative Burley has a quick follow-up to that.
Quick one. This is kind of new information for me as well. So, and by the way, this is really nice. I like this. Thank you. When you deal with drinking water, are you dealing just with water delivery systems, or do you also does your jurisdiction also include wells, for example, if people are getting their drinking water out of wells?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I think on slide two, in terms of where it comes from, the public individual wells are not public water systems. We don't know how many individual wells there are. That's something that Mr. Beiler and his shop oversees. And, of course, we don't deal with bottled water. That's a USDA food product and a large and growing business. But everything else other than anything from four connections on up to 250,000 or so, whatever the bull run is, that's our responsibility. Now, what we do is not just deal with it from the treatment center on, but from the water source on. And part of our responsibility under US EPA and part of our terrific partnership with DEQ is to identify and assess risks and vulnerabilities of all the drinking water sources for these public water systems around the state. And I will tell you that the DEQ staff and our drinking water staff have done some incredibly terrific work over the past 7 years it took them, but they've now done the reports and the assessments for those drinking water systems. And so local communities can identify, here's where we get our water, here's the drainage basin, here's some of the hydrological realities for that source, and here are some possible areas of concern, whether it's I don't want to pick on an industry, but you know, whether it's an underground storage tank or whether it's a gas station dry cleaner, you know, et cetera, et cetera. If there are issues that the water providers and the local communities need to be aware of to protect the source of their water, of course, it's a heck of a lot cheaper and easier and better to have good water coming in than to try to treat the heck out of it out of bad water coming in. And so we recognize that at source to tap, contamination can occur, and so we assure those health standards source to tap as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Gail, why don't you just go ahead and continue, because we are running short on time.
No, I just want to call your attention to, and I wish I had the slide number here. There are a couple pie charts. One of them is Oregon Water Systems by size. And I want, if you would, note that of those 3,600 and some public water systems in the state, exactly four of them serve more than 100,000 people. That 90% of them serve fewer than 500 people. So we are talking literally thousands of small public water systems. They could be a retirement mobile home park, a church, a school, a gas station, a small community, and those folks are running public utilities and are subject to all of the health standards. As you can imagine, they don't have the large environmental engineering staffs and a lot of the technology, sophistication, education, and consequently, they struggle. They struggle to reliably meet those minimum health standards. And that's what we are facing here in Oregon. The good news is the water, we've got good water here in Oregon, pretty good. And thanks to some advances in health standards during the 1970s, it got a lot better. We got the bugs out of the water, basically, by requiring filtration of the water. There is a slide that has to do with what I call Oregon's Sickening Six, the drinking water contaminants. And the first one are the acute diseases. Those are the microbials and various bugs. Two through six, we're not doing so good on. And the problem is that they are chronic and difficult to you don't get immediately sick from drinking water that has too much radon or that has too much lead or that has too much volatile organics. Not like if you were drinking water with crypto. And so we simply don't have the data to identify exactly where the concerns are. We have been very successful, as I said, in dealing with the acute diseases. And if that's all we had to worry about, I wouldn't be taking up your time or mine. But we've got a lot more work to do, and we're not getting it done. there is a slide here that in fact says what's not being done. And I just picked out a few of what I consider rather critical functions to show you kind of where we are in our current capacity. And frankly, not to make too silly a pun on it, but we've got our glass is about half full. We've got about half the program that we need, state and county together, to ensure that we have safe drinking water around the state. What we really have is a health disparity. As I said, those larger systems have the technology, the sophistication, the understanding, the know-how. It's the smaller, more rural systems that are struggling, that need our assistance, that really are at that short end of that stick. And we in public health simply believe that that's an intolerable situation. It's not just us saying we need more money, we need more capacity. The Secretary of State's audit identified that, in fact, we are falling short and identified several measures for us to take. We have taken all of them that don't require more money. And that leaves us to today. We have a three-part problem, and we are working hard at a three-part solution. The first is we don't have enough capacity to deal with existing EPA rules. The second is we don't have enough capacity to even adopt the new rules that some of those slides tell you about. And thirdly, we are not doing our statutory requirement of helping the small systems, those 4 to 14 connection systems, at all. Those are non-EPA systems. They're not required under the federal government. They are in Oregon State Statute ORS 448. We are not, we are doing bupkis. We simply have no capacity on a proactive way to provide them assistance. We certainly answer the phone, help them out, you know, as if and when they contact us. But we're determined to, so we were faced with a challenge to either get the capacity to help or ask you to take that out of the statute. And again, as public health, we couldn't get there to say that the small systems don't deserve health protection. So we are looking for a three-part solution that that frankly in total adds up to about the price of 50% of the price of one bottle of water per Oregonian per year. And we think if people are willing to pay something like $12 or $15 a gallon for bottled water in the pint bottles, that a dollar per year is a pretty good deal to ensure that this health disparity is dealt with and people all over the state can rely on drinking water. So that three-part solution is made up of three parts. That is a general fund request that we have in that's part of the governor's budget, about $2.6 million in additional general fund dollars, which would frankly allow us for the first time to fully fund the drinking water program in the state of Oregon. Second, we are continuing on with then Chair Jensen's terrific leadership from last session and the session before in following the advice of a statewide task force that we had put together, and are requesting in House Bill 2187 the authority to charge a fee sufficient to recover the cost of conducting the on-site inspections that are one of those key critical functions that's on that page that I showed you. And the third piece is the federal matching dollars that that fee will allow us to generate. Right now we're continuing to leave federal dollars on the table because frankly we simply don't have enough in state matching funds to access all the federal dollars that are available. Don't get me wrong, the federal dollars are not sufficient, but we're not even maxing out on those. So this fee will allow us to do that. Added to the general fund, we will then be able to ensure that current rules and safeguards are adequately and evenly assured across the state, that the new rules, we have the capacity to deal with that, and that the small systems get the attention that the Oregon statute requires. So that's our drinking water funding piece. The companion piece, I guess, if you will, to that for drinking water is Senate Bill 156. What Senate Bill 156 does is establish a statutory state drinking water advisory committee to advise and assist public health in assuring that, in fact, there is safe and adequate clean drinking water everywhere around the state. So we have this is modeled on our food service advisory committee. We have a radiation protection advisory committee. We think drinking water is fundamental enough to call for its advisory committee as well. So for drinking water, That's our need. That's our attempt. I'm happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you so much, Ms. Shipley, and we apologize for the video snafu there.
I don't know what my password might be, but...
Well, but I appreciate it, and I know you'll be coming back in front of this committee shortly to discuss that bill, House Bill 2187. Any questions? Yes.
Thank
Representative
you,
Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just very quickly, Gail, your last slide suggests that the state may be at risk of losing its primacy. Are we close to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, that's a great question that frankly I'm not sure I want to know the answer to. You will find folks who are very well informed, long-time drinking water providers, system operators who say EPA is never going to take it away from us. You know, it's one of those be careful what you ask for because they don't have the capacity either. On the other hand, we have given it back in Oregon before. We gave it back in the 80s. And then we took it back again because we didn't like how that turned out. EPA, the regional EPA in Seattle, I believe in 03 session of the legislature, wrote to then Chair Jensen and Chair Winters on the Senate side, delineating their specific concerns about our chronic underperformance of our federal regulations. So are we at risk? More than I would like to be.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Well, I think you raise a good point, and part of it is also our citizens of Oregon at risk because we don't really know the quality of their drinking water.
As I, Madam Chair, as I chat with people, I often meet them for lunch or coffee or something to talk with them about drinking water, and invariably, you know, we'll also have a glass of water there at the table, and as they know they're talking, and rather skeptical, and I understand we're talking, you know, millions of dollars here, and you want to make sure that it's, you know, really important and necessary. And they start to drink, and I say, you know, how lucky you feeling today? And I don't want to suggest that drinking water is unsafe in Oregon. Far from it. In fact, drink more water, everyone, please. It's good for you. But the reality is, if we don't test, we don't know. And we believe the public's health is too important to leave that the way it is.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay, next up, we will hear from the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And I have the extreme pleasure of hearing Director Shetterly for the second time today. This is my lucky day, Lane. Do you want to have Bob come up with you and share in the fun?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll ask Bob to play with the computer while I'm testifying.
This is a test. You can make it work.
He brought some slides for you today.
The good news is we did not. Madam Chair, members of the committee.
You could shut that if you... Yeah.
It's somebody else's. I'm afraid to do it.
We haven't quite made it in the 21st century yet.
I am the seventh from my ass.
We've had a lot of staff additions to the department. I didn't think I was that far behind in the new folks.
And they're getting younger all the time.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm pleased to be with you. Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and to my left, Bob Rindy, our policy advisor for the department. I am pleased to accept the invitation to present a brief overview, and with apologies to Madam Chair, I see Representative Burley may have taken the opportunity to mishearing me twice today as I was in the Ways and Means subcommittee earlier this morning, and Representative Burley was on that committee as well. What I will try to do is give you a very brief overview of the work of the department generally, how it fits in with the land use program, and touch briefly on some of our most recent activities and what we see looking forward, particularly our involvement in Ballot Measure 37 and the Big Look Task Force that was created under Senate Bill 82 last session to undertake a comprehensive review of the statewide land use planning program and to make recommendations to the 2009 Legislative Assembly for appropriate changes in the program. Just in a bit of history, because really our department is a function of the statewide land use program, it's worth just touching base briefly on the program itself. It was created in 1973 under Senate Bill 100, and if I could capture the sense of the program as it was created in 1973, and really as it has fundamentally remained in the years since, it was to focus urban development in Oregon within urban areas. There are efficiencies in land that are achieved by that. There are efficiencies in costs of development achieved by that. And generally, you have healthier communities when you have concentration of urban development inside urban areas. The corollary to that is that the program provides fewer opportunities for development and urban activities outside of urban areas, outside of urban growth boundaries, particularly in farm and forest lands. Again, in 1973, the strong thesis being to protect those lands for their productive economic uses. But again, it really is a two-sided coin, one to focus urban development inside urban areas, thereby strengthening our cities and communities, and at the same time maintaining a lower level of development and certainly urban activity outside of those urban areas. Senate Bill 100 established the Land Conservation and Development Commission and the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and it tasked the commission to create statewide planning goals that would provide a framework in addition to the statute to the statewide planning program. So for its first couple of years, LCDC and through it the department were engaged in creating the first 15 of what we have now, 19 statewide land use planning goals. The four later goals, or our coastal goals, came in a few years after 1975. But by 1975, those first 15 goals were in place. And then came the directive, again under Senate Bill 100, for cities and counties to adopt comprehensive plans to regulate their own land uses within their respective city and county jurisdictions in consistent with the overarching principles laid out in the statewide planning program. At the time, and it drew some smiles in the subcommittee this morning, but the expectation was that it would take a year or so for cities and counties all to adopt their comprehensive plans. And in fact, it took a lot longer than that. I think I'm right in that it was finished around 1989 when the last county finished its last appeal through the courts, and all of our cities and counties had adopted their comprehensive plans. The role of the department during those years was to provide technical assistance to those cities and counties in the process of developing their comprehensive plans. And the role of LCDC was to acknowledge those comprehensive plans, because once those plans have been acknowledged or were acknowledged by LCDC, they became blessed as being consistent with state law and thereby could be implemented by the cities and counties, and land use decisions made by cities and counties with acknowledged comprehensive plans could be made directly under and with reference to those acknowledged comprehensive plans. The work of the department has continued really even since then along very similar lines, largely in providing technical assistance. Since we got all of the cities and counties acknowledged, although there are two that are not acknowledged now, those are our two newest cities, Damascus and, as of November, the city of Lapine. We're sort of recreating history with them now in working with them to establish acknowledged comprehensive plans. But since the cities and counties initially got through the acknowledgement process, the next wave was periodic review, recognizing that it was one thing to have a comprehensive plan that was consistent with state law, but also recognizing that time changes things, and those plans quickly became out of date, not only in terms of compliance with regular changes by the legislature in what state law was going to require, and also by rule adoption at LCDC and court decisions, but also recognizing simply market forces change and cities and counties need to keep their comp plans up to date so that they're better able to respond to development opportunities and challenges that come their way. So after the first wave of acknowledgments were accomplished, we moved into the period of periodic review, where cities and counties were required to undertake periodically the review of their comprehensive plans to make sure that they were brought up to date with new requirements and also with their current community vision. That work is ongoing, although as of last session, the number of cities and counties that are subject to periodic review has been drastically reduced. But still, again, that is very much part of what we do in working with cities and counties in that periodic review process. Otherwise, when cities and counties, again, having adopted comprehensive plans that have been acknowledged by LCDC, when they undertake to amend their comprehensive plans through what we call a plan amendment, our department is involved in many cases in providing technical assistance to the cities and counties to make sure that those amendments comply with state law and also guiding them through the process. If I could describe our mission as a department in two steps, it's really two things. Technical assistance, we have staff in Salem and we have staff deployed statewide in offices that work hand in hand with local governments. Providing technical assistance to assist them in complying with state law and moving forward the visions of their local communities under their comprehensive plans. And the other way that we partner with local governments, and I think is very important for the state, and I hope the state recognizes, and that is through fiscal assistance, providing grant programs to cities and counties, because this costs money. The state has implemented a land use planning program. We expect cities and counties to operate in accordance with it. It does cost them money, and so the state does provide fiscal assistance as well. And those have been the two components, technical assistance and fiscal assistance, that are the backbone of the program. The Land Conservation and Development Commission oversees the work of this department, DLCD. The commission is composed of 7 members appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. They represent various regions and interests in the state, city, county, development interests, and those particular constituencies are actually identified in statute, in the statute that creates LCDC. Again, LCDC then oversees the operation of the department itself, and in fact, as came up in this morning's discussion in the subcommittee downstairs, LCDC is also the appointing authority for the director. And my position is not directly by appointment from the governor. LCDC is assisted in its work by 2 standing statutory committees. There is the Citizen Involvement Advisory Committee that advises the commission relative to citizen involvement, which happens to be goal 1 of the statewide land use planning goals. It's a very important part of our statewide program. And LCDC is also advised by another standing statutory committee, the Local Officials Advisory Committee, which by its name is made up of elected officials, and we also have an adjunct ex officio group of professional planning staff from cities and counties that also sit with the Local Officials Advisory Committee. Working down quickly on my testimony, and then I want to get to the Measure 37 and Senate Bill 82, touch on those, and then I'll be happy to answer questions. Some of the things that that we are involved in directly on as programs for the department, one is working with local governments on economic development. We are a participating agency with the governor's economic revitalization team, and in fact, we have our own economic development planning team within the department that works with cities and counties on their economic development planning strategies. Under Building Great Communities, that is our urban program, again working with cities primarily who are looking at urban growth boundary amendments, making sure that, number one, they comply with state law, but also helping to share best practices and showing what has worked well for cities around the state to help provide some guidance to communities that are going through urban growth boundary amendments. In the integration of land use and transportation, that is a key element of the program, and I think becoming more and more important as transportation dollars have to get stretched farther and farther by virtue of the constraints that we have in our transportation funding. This program is a joint program of ODOT and DLCD. It recognizes that decisions that we and that communities make relative to land use have huge impacts on transportation demands. By the same token, decisions that ODOT and local communities make relative to transportation also have impacts on land use, and that those two areas of decision-making need to be coordinated. We also provide, through our TGM program, grants to local governments, particularly for transportation-related planning and, in some cases, projects. The fourth bullet there, supporting local plans and implementation, kind of gets at the core of the program. We do have a general fund grants program that is available statewide to cities and counties that helps support their planning efforts. We also assist particularly small communities through direct staff assistance, and in fact, in some parts of the state, our deployed staff, our regional staff, really almost serves as adjunct planning staff for some smaller cities and counties. I mentioned the TGM program. Again, we provide technical assistance and consulting services there, as well as grant programs. And our coastal program is something that doesn't often get elevated as a separate item of discussion, but it is worth pointing out. The coastal program through the department really is the source by which federal dollars come into the state for the for Oregon's coastal zone management program. And we provide not only the standard array of services to coastal communities, but also through the federal funding, some extra services in terms of hazards planning, working in estuaries and particular planning needs that don't apply to the rest of the state, and through federal dollars, even some direct project funding that we're able to do with those federal dollars that we're not able to do through the rest of the state. We have a rural program focused on Goal 3 and Goal 4. We watch very carefully the activities statewide around agricultural lands and forest lands. Obviously, with ballot measure 37, that has become a little bit more problematic, but at least in terms of local plan amendments and zoning decisions that impact agricultural and forest lands, we provide technical assistance and oversight on those as well. I mentioned the ocean and coastal program. I won't go over that again. On the back of the page, there's another program that we have that's not widely known, but if you were in a local community, you would probably be aware of it, and that is our FEMA program. We receive FEMA funding primarily around flood and hazards planning. FEMA nationally has embarked on an update of the flood maps. As you can imagine, in local communities, where those flood zones are is a critical piece of knowledge in terms of the development decisions you're going to make. And our maps, both in Oregon and nationally, are woefully out of date. FEMA has embarked on a national update of those maps, and we are the agency that is helping to implement that at the state level. We also provide assistance to local communities through this program in helping them to qualify for the federal flood insurance program for the benefit of their citizens. Under Measure 37, we are probably ground zero for the measure here in the state of the roughly 6,500 or so ballot Measure 37 claims that have come into the state. About 98%, and I think probably more than 98%, we're close to 99%, are claims that ultimately come to my department for evaluation and resolution because they implicate either statutes, goals, or administrative rules that implement the statewide land use planning program. We work in concert with the Department of Administrative Services and with the Department of Justice to process claims, and it's important for you to know that, as I think you probably do from reading the newspapers, things took a dramatic turn in about the last 4 or 5 weeks before December 4 of last year. That's when the claims process changed. And it became more difficult to file a ballot Measure 37 claim. Recognizing that change was coming, there was a strong interest out in the public to get those claims in, and in they came. As I mentioned, we have about 6,500 claims or so to the state so far. Roughly half of those came in within the last 4 weeks before the December 4 change in the process. We are at a point, and I was not bashful in telling the subcommittee downstairs at this point, that neither the state nor counties, which are really facing the same problem, we are not in a position where we are going to be able to process all of these claims within the 180-day timeline that's authorized or permitted under ballot measure 37, the default being risk of liability for damages, attorney fees, and costs if claims are not resolved within that 180-day time frame. Given the volume of claims that came in, we will be asking it for some form of relief at some point here sooner than later, both for the state but also for our local partners in dealing with the volume of claims that came in. Quickly, I'll finish up here, and I won't go through all of the rest of this, but for our, so that you know what, the way the department works, we are housed here in Salem. We share space with the Department of Agriculture in the Ag Building. But we have field offices in Walport, in Portland, primarily dealing with the metro area, in LeGrand, dealing with northeastern Oregon, in Bend, dealing with central and other parts of eastern Oregon, in Central Point for the southern part of the state, and in Eugene for southern Lane County and that area. So those are the folks who are out actually in the field working with local communities directly. We do have our statewide specialists in Salem as well that provide services out of Salem, and they travel quite a bit. We have a department that is on the road a lot. I'm on the road a lot, and we do believe that getting out and meeting with our local government partners is the best way to communicate and provide the kind of services and assistance that we are equipped to provide. I want to skip down to the challenges ahead. I mentioned the 180-day deadline on Measure 37 claims that will be looming soon for us, and also recognizing that in July of this year, while there's been a moratorium on periodic review and far fewer jurisdictions are subject to periodic review now than in the past, the fact is, I think we have 12 or 13 jurisdictions in Metro alone in July of this year that will be coming live onto the schedule for periodic review, and that obviously implicates workload issues as well as budget issues, not only for us, but for those local communities as well. Nothing we haven't anticipated, but I wanted to at least let you know that that's on the horizon. We have industrial concepts that we're putting forward, one relating to industrial reserves. That would authorize the commission to engage in rulemaking to streamline the process for identifying potentially prime industrial lands adjacent to an urban growth boundary, designate that as urban industrial reserve, as industrial reserve, and thereby put it in first priority for inclusion in a urban growth boundary expansion. We have a concept that would do very much the same kind of thing for affordable housing, allowing cities to work with willing property owners to designate property that would be available for a for affordable housing, and in doing that, provide it with a streamlined process for inclusion into the urban growth boundary. Both of these, including some restrictions, one on the industrial piece, that the property brought into for industrial would have to be used for industrial and would include significant limitations on any conversion, so that we are actually using this designated land for industrial purposes and not creating an incentive to bring land in and then convert it to some other use. And same on the affordable housing, some significant limitations that would maintain that as land for affordable housing, but as in trade for that, providing local communities, again working voluntarily with property owners, some relief from what they have now in the way of state preemption of things like inclusionary zoning and other price controls that they're not, cities and counties are not authorized to utilize, this method being a way that they may be able to do that on a voluntary basis with willing property owners. Another bill is a fairly arcane and technical one dealing with the standard review for administrative rules. I'll be happy to answer that questions on that, but I don't think I'll include that as part of my overview. Madam Chair, that's fast, and it's hopefully a little faster even than what I did in the subcommittee downstairs. But let me just end my presentation by calling to your attention my very low-tech, but entirely satisfactory piece that I've distributed to you, and that is our biennial report. I commend it to you. We have tried to make it readable, and it will do a good job, I think, if you have heard this very brief summary of the department's work and the program. This will fill in a lot of gaps. It will provide a lot of additional information, both historic and looking forward. And so please take that. We will be distributing it generally to the membership here this week. And Lastly, I will certainly be pleased to make myself and my staff available to you, both in the committee and individually, as you may need for either your concerns, questions, interests, or those of your constituents. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. And it is a pleasure to hear you for the second time today.
Sorry.
Although I'm afraid you may be giving us talk in your sleep tonight.
Madam Chair, it's measure 37 that I babble in my sleep, actually. This is a good change of pace.
Yeah, I'm sure the pillow talk on that is not something we want to hear.
I blush.
That's not an easy thing to do either, I know, make you blush. I will start with Representative Burley has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The subcommittee this morning, Ways and Means, the chair said that we weren't allowed to bring up policy questions. I don't think we have that prohibition here now, do
That's
we?
Right.
Fire away.
And I don't know how much time we have either, but I would like to explore this matter about the affordable housing a little bit more, if you could elaborate on that some, please.
Our bill number is 187. I do believe it'll be introduced on the Senate side, Senate Bill 187. And thanks for the inquiry. It directs the commission to do rulemaking. First of all, anticipate there would be a substantial level of detail in this, and so rather than answering it all in statute, it would direct the commission to do rulemaking to authorize a city, because we're talking here about urban growth boundary expansions, and again, true to the program, we're talking about putting this housing inside urban areas, to authorize a city to work with a willing property owner who would be able to designate land adjacent to an urban growth boundary to say, I will designate this as affordable housing. So designated, and help me, Bob, in my colloquial description of this, that land is available for inclusion in the urban growth boundary above and beyond the usual 20-year land supply for housing, with the proviso that it come in with at least a certain percentage dedicated to affordable housing, and not only on the day that it comes in, but also because of the restrictions that the bill will direct and that will be included in the rules, that it be maintained for affordable housing. And that's why this bill, working cooperatively with property owners, would allow cities to implement restrictions on price and other kinds of controls that currently are not available to them under state law, so that they could maintain this on an ongoing and long-term basis for affordable housing. Cities were concerned that, would they also have the ability to, if they had some undeveloped land inside the urban growth boundary, how could they take advantage of this opportunity if it didn't really require expanding an urban growth boundary? And I think the way the bill addresses that is that if a city is going to can designate undeveloped land inside an urban growth boundary, and if you have a willing property owner who is willing to say, I will subject myself and this property to these limitations on use and price and other terms, then the city would be able to replace that land in an urban growth boundary expansion. We think that we've worked with developers in helping put this together and housing advocates, and we believe that with the right balance of land that would be required to be maintained for affordable housing, not requiring all of the land inside this kind of an urban growth boundary expansion to be used for affordable housing, we can create a scenario where the developer can make money and the local affordable housing,
housing authority.
Yeah, housing authority. I'm trying to think of the community development. That's right. Organization would be able to partner with a developer, and we're hoping give this an opportunity to see if this is at least one way to address the housing concerns that have come up here in the last few years.
Okay. Great.
Thanks,
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Microphone there.
Lane. In relationship to ballot measure 37 and the umpteen thousand that you have that have come in, can you give me some idea of how much of those is what perhaps I would call development property, and how much of it is simply a landowner wanting to build a home?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Jensen, we can only give you preliminary numbers right now because the inbox, or DAS, is still sorting through the inbox, and so there is a host of claims that have not yet been categorized at that. If we're talking about a claim for a home, basically, I could have built a home on my rural parcel before, but now as a consequence of some state land use regulation, I can't. Single home claims are coming in well under the 10% of claims.
Okay.
Then above that, you have two varieties, and these we don't have broken out yet, although, again, that will come. You have a claims for land division, which may be three or four additional parcels, and all the way up to major subdivisions. And those are hard to identify, but at least between the one home versus some form of land division, we're in the range of 10% or less for a single home kind of Measure 37 claim.
Okay. Thank you. Follow-up. Another question, if I may. You started out with some things that I kind of perhaps have missed, but you said urban development in urban areas. And you, as I'm recalling, you talked something about creates something of a healthier environment. Is that correct?
I think I said healthier communities. The thesis being that if we place jobs, if we place urban uses inside urban areas where people are living, then it's going to require less in the way of infrastructure to develop those. That means less public cost, more efficient use, not only of land, but then of public dollars for those services, and certainly less in the way of need for travel to and from. Again, if we can concentrate those urban uses inside those urban areas. Yeah, that's really one of the fundamental theses of the program.
Madam Chair, if I am allowed the opportunity to editorialize for a moment here, and I admit I have to do a... I would have to do a literature research on this before I'd want to go too far with it. But certainly in light of the literature coming out of the first half of the 20th century, particularly out of the Chicago School and a group of scholars there, the findings would be exactly the opposite of this, I think. That too much congestion of people creates an unhealthy environment. And I'm not going to question in terms, or do I mean to be questioning in terms of this, perhaps the efficiency that may go with that. But to imply that efficiency always creates a more healthy environment, and I'm not talking just in terms of physical health, but social health as well, that efficiency leads to a healthier environment, I think is, I believe, is contradictory to the scientific findings that we would have, and we spend a lot of time in this building and have in this committee, and I'm sure we will in this committee again this year, look at, you know, the scientific findings in the making of decisions that that we make. So, and I don't know that I'm asking the director for a response to that, but it's just a matter that I have as curiosity. And it, quite frankly, Madam Chair, it's been something that's been kind of bothering me. But as I get older, sometimes it takes more years for me to be able to be, you know, formulate my thoughts to exactly what it is that I'm looking at. So, thank you.
No, actually, if I may, Madam Chair, not in the way to answer or even to argue necessarily, although I think there's probably research. My point is this. What I describe really is the thesis that underlies the planning program. And it's pretty expressed. It's not a hidden thesis. And that really is looking at, and historically at the program. You mentioned literature review, and I think that's an interesting suggestion, because that is actually one of the issues that the Big Look Task Force is engaged in, a literature review, and they have a specific work group that is looking at urban growth management strategies. And so they are looking at not only the Oregon approach, which has been containment within urban growth boundaries, or at least to largely focus development within urban growth boundaries, They've been looking not only at what we've done here in Oregon, but they've been looking at other states over the past 30 years and also, frankly, what other countries are doing. And there's a lot of literature review that's going on and will continue to go on as part of the big look. And I can't predict right now what they will come back with, but I can assure you that that is front and center, one of the issues that they're looking at, sort of, this was the path we chose. Have we chosen the right path? And in the last 30 years, have there been other enlightened states, countries, jurisdictions from which we can learn and do even a better job? So I'm not afraid to ask that question. I think it's a worthwhile question to examine.
Thank you very much, Lane, and thank you, Madam Chair, for indulging us for a minute on that.
Thank you. I was wondering, and I have to have you two meet outside in the hall and decide that one, but I thought that was a very good discourse there. Appreciate it. Any other quick questions for Mr. Shetterly as we are moving on to air quality and air pollution, which is a very good segue right here? Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Chairwoman. You mentioned the 19 goals upon which the foundation of our land use planning system.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from the four that were added after the original 15, have there been any changes in those goals?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Cannon. Yes, on almost an ongoing basis. In the last 2 years, we have amended Goal 14, which is our urbanization goal, to as the first step of a process of streamlining the urban growth boundary expansion process. We've also amended Goal 11 as it relates to the provision of sewer services outside of urban areas. And we've also amended Goal 8, the recreation goal, to address destination resorts in follow-up to some legislation that was enacted 2 years ago. So the answer is those goals have been far from static. They have been changing. And, in fact, I think on our website we have a record of the history of those goals and the amendments that have occurred to the goals over time.
We actually amended Goal 14 twice.
Twice, that's true.
And just to clarify, that's done through rulemaking?
It is done through the Land Conservation and Development Commission. The process is LCDC usually appoints a task force that is representative of state, city, and other private interests, depending on the nature of the amendment being considered. And then prior to adoption by LCDC, if you're talking about a goal, we're required to conduct 10 hearings statewide, and it does require they be done on a statewide basis. And then the record of those hearings is transmitted back to LCDC before LCDC makes a decision on the amendment. We're also required to take that proposed goal amendment to the Local Officials Advisory Committee. And the only exception, again, as of last session, being that if the legislature says amend this goal, that dispenses with the 10 hearing requirements, since we're acting directly in response to a legislative enactment.
Did you have a quick follow-up?
Yeah,
but they are rules. They are.
Right.
They are.
There's
a goal is just a specie of administrative rule. That is correct.
It sounds like that. A quick follow-up, if I may. It sounds like that process is very public, very inclusive, very deliberative. Is it your professional opinion that these goals, these 19 goals, are largely consistent with the public will, with the majority of what the public expects from its land use system?
Wow, good question.
We're throwing you some hardballs here
no,
today.
No, this is Lane. Wonderful. This is fun. Madam Chair and Representative Cannon, my gut tells me yes, largely so. I mean, if you look at them, their public involvement, their coordination, they are agriculture, forestry, urbanization, transportation. I mean, they're things that we recognize probably as fundamental. How they address each of those values, I think, may be where some of the rubs are. But getting back to Representative Jensen's question, a review of the goals and the question, do these goals from 1973, as they have been modified since then, still reflect our values today, or are there goals that we should amend substantially? Are there new goals that we should add that aren't in there? Water. You won't find water explicitly, for instance, as a land use planning goal. Hard to dismiss as an impact on land use. Should there be a goal that addresses water? That question about whether the goals currently reflect Oregon's values is again one of those issues that the Big Look Task Force has been assigned to address, and they are aggressively.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
I need to just a quick point on this.
Okay.
The issue of water, Madam Chair, is one that
I have argued before leadership here should be a part of the committee that does land use planning. Because I don't think you can do land use planning without considering water policy and water availability serves that. And there is some pretty good stuff coming out of the University of Montana, a lady there whose name gets away from me, but if there's any interest on your part or your agency's part in that material, I've tried to look it up for you.
Madam Chair, just briefly, I'm sorry, but this is so much fun. this because it also comes out of Representative Jensen's district, this issue of water. It was a decision by the Umatilla County Board of Commissioners last summer to adopt what's called a go below, and that allows the county to reduce the minimum lot size in exclusive farm use to below 80 acres based on certain criteria. Not changing the use, it's still agriculture, but recognizing that a smaller lot size may be appropriate. Umatilla County had itself established a 160 and 240 acre minimum, I think, in certain ag zones. They wanted to go to a 20 acre minimum lot size in a particular area of potentially wine growing country. We ended up, the department recommended approval of that. We were out on a limb a little bit. The commission recommended approval of that. We heard from the neighbors very serious concerns about the impact of that intensity of agricultural activity on their wells. And frankly, the response of the commission was, that's out of our hands. We have to make this decision irrespective of water availability. And it was very frustrating, I think, for everybody that they wanted to talk about water, and the commission was certainly cognizant of it, but didn't have any jurisdictional authority really to factor that into the decision.
Madam Chair?
Yes, follow up.
Could I ask the director how do we solve that so they do have some jurisdictional authority?
Madam Chair, I'll be happy to defer to the legislature on who gets that ball.
I'd like to talk to you about it.
Yeah, that is a huge issue, because as you know, that water has been divided, I think, among several state agencies in terms of who has responsibility for what. And I think it's that is an issue that at some point is going to have to be dealt with.
Well, Madam Chair, if I could just add one thing about water. Probably what many people are talking about is water outside urban growth boundaries. Yeah. Bob Rendy, for the record. City in urban areas for urban growth boundaries, there is a requirement that there be planning for that's urban specific. Water systems. Right. Many times that's a city. In many places that's a city or special districts, and there is also a coordination requirement in the statute so that's being done in a coordinated manner. But he's correct. There's certainly a much lower level of requirement from land use standpoint outside of urban growth boundaries.
Thank you, Representative Jensen, for bringing that up, because, as you know, that's a big interest that I have, and I'd be happy to work with you on that. And maybe we can sit down with Mr. Shetterly and I think Mr. Phil Ward from the Water Resources Department, because that is one, I think, policy area that really falls through the cracks, and that's one that we need to really pay attention to, especially as the development pressures outside of urban growth boundaries increase. So with that, I want to thank you for being here today and committee for your attention on this. We'll be hearing more on land use issues later in the session.
I look forward to it. Thanks
thank
again.
You.
Madam Chair, I promise not to ask any more questions until you get to air.
And speaking of which, thank you. And our last panel today is from the Department of Environmental Quality. We have Andy Ginsberg, who is the Air Quality Administrator. Let's see if he passes the test of making the PowerPoint work.
Yeah, right.
This is like who gets voted off the island here. So I've asked Mr. Ginsberg to come talk today about benzene, which is an issue that I've heard a lot from my constituents. It's a federal issue but affects Oregon and the whole Northwest, and also clean diesel, which we will hear more from in this committee later. And then I see that smoke has been listed, so I'm not sure how you're going to talk about smoke, but maybe you can clarify for us what you'll cover today. But thanks for coming here. I appreciate it. And for the record.
Chair Dinkfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, and I very much appreciate the chance to be here to talk to you about smoke and benzene and diesel. And I will
see that you passed the test.
And I passed the test. And I'd like to thank Gail for working out all the bugs on this. And I will, in particular, spend some time on benzene because I know there were some questions the other day about what the federal government is doing about benzene. I intend to cover that.
And just to be clear, we need to leave this room by 5 to 3.
And
so we'll
be quick.
Yeah, and I want to leave some time for questions because I'm sure there will be some. Thank you.
Okay, and you should have a handout. This is just to give you an overview of what we're doing in the Oregon Clean Air Initiative this session. I'm not going to talk about all these items, but give you a sense that the items we are going to talk about, smoke, benzene, and diesel, are part of a bigger effort that we're working on at DEQ. In particular, I'm going to focus on two pieces of legislation to address these particular concerns, and I'll come back to these later in the presentation, but Senate Bill 338, Heat Smart, addresses wood stoves, and House Bill 2172 addresses our clean diesel efforts. And this slide is to show why we're concerned about these two particular issues, or these three issues really. On the left you can see a chart of toxic air pollution in Oregon. These are the three most significant toxic air pollutants: combustion byproducts, benzene, and diesel particulate emissions. They cause a number of health effects, and they're all many times over the health benchmarks set by our commission. And on the right you see a map of the state showing areas that are at or near federal health standards for fine particulate or smoke. And that's, Madam Chair, why I wanted to talk about smoke as well, because EPA has recently tightened the standard for smoke or fine particulate based on new health information showing it's more hazardous than previously thought. Those two areas with the red crosses are areas that will violate the federal standards. The areas that are blue circles are areas that are just under them, and if they have a bad winter this year, they'll violate. And the other areas, the diamonds or the triangles, are not likely to violate, but they're above areas that we're concerned about from a health standpoint. And
Representative Smith, question.
Thank you. Back on your map, maybe it's just a typo. In the Hermiston area, those two circles are in Gillum County. Is it the Hermiston Airshed or the Pendleton's in Morrow County?
It's probably the way this slide laid out, but yeah, Hermiston and Pendleton are the two areas that we're focused on there.
Okay.
Yeah, Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to make sure I understand this, what this is telling us, I mean, the map says federal fine particulate standards. So where they're out of compliance based on this thing, it's more than just the diesel, benzene. It's other fine particulates as well, correct?
And Madam Chair, Representative Burley, that's correct. The federal government sets standards for certain air pollutants, national standards. And for fine particulates, we are actually going to be violating those standards based on the change EPA just made. For benzene and diesel, there are no national standards. There's a lot of emerging information about that. There are health benchmarks, but there aren't official standards to violate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And just briefly on the health effects, I won't dwell on this since we don't have a lot of time, but we're concerned about the smoke or fine particulate because it's a primary cause of asthma and other heart and respiratory problems. Benzene has been linked to leukemia, and diesel exhaust is our concern there is lung cancer as well as other heart and lung disorders. And also diesel exhaust is a contributor to global warming. So the sources of these pollutants, starting with fine particulate, you can see in this pie chart here the largest slice is wood stoves, and that may be surprising to some people, but when we look at the areas of the state that are over the or close to the federal standard, those are all areas that are heavily dependent on wood for residential heating. Typically, we violate the standard in the winter when people are burning a lot of wood, and when there are inversions, and so that's why woodstoves show up so so prominently. There are, of course, other sources, and in some particular places, other sources like industry can contribute, but really in every area that, that we struggle with the standard, woodstoves are front and center of the problem that we are trying to address. And in terms of benzene, the biggest issue is gasoline. And you can see on this chart, the large blue slice are benzene emissions from cars that are traveling on the road. And the yellow slice, slightly to the left, are benzene emissions from other non-road gasoline engines, such as lawnmowers. When you add the two of them together, you can see why gasoline is such a concern for benzene. But look at the red slice, and you'll see that wood stoves are also a very significant source of benzene emissions. And then this pie shows diesel emissions. And most people, when you think of diesel, you think of on-road trucks, long-haul trucks. And you can see they show up there in yellow prominently. But they're only one of many sources of diesel emissions. We also have trains and agricultural equipment and construction equipment contributing. And I want to also just point out that small slice that says buses, it's actually more important than it appears because it also includes school buses, and there's a lot of exposure of school children to old smoky diesel engines. So what can we do about it? And the good news is there's a lot we can do about it. In Oregon, we developed a program called the Certified Wood Stove Program. We were the first state in the nation to develop this program, and you can see from this bar chart, an uncertified stove compared to a certified stove, there's a 70% reduction in the emissions of particulate. We also have a 25% reduction in the benzene emissions, and we cut the carbon dioxide or global warming emissions in half by using a certified stove. So there's a lot we can do to replace our old uncertified stoves with new certified stoves to address three different types of pollution problems. In terms of benzene, gasoline, in addition to wood stoves, gasoline is the largest source of benzene emissions, as I mentioned. On the left is a picture of a refinery, and that's there to represent the benzene that's actually in the gasoline. That's something that the federal government has jurisdiction over that we really can't address here locally. Once EPA establishes their standards, we're preempted from establishing our own. EPA has proposed a rule to reduce the benzene content of gasoline, but the way they designed this particular rule, it allows companies to average their benzene emissions from one refinery to another, and we end up in the Northwest with the highest benzene content in gasoline in the nation after EPA's rule is adopted. So EPA's rule will result in benzene reductions across the nation, including in Oregon, but we still, after EPA's rule is finalized, end up with the highest benzene content in gasoline in the nation. Based on that, Senator Wyden contacted EPA and let them know that he was not satisfied with that outcome. Following that and a hold that he put on one of EPA's nominations, we've been working with EPA and urging them to revise the rule so that it provides some more protection to the Northwest. We along with our partners in Washington, are in the same boat. The last thing I heard about that is that EPA is likely to revise the rule to address our concerns, and that we'll end up with benzene and gasoline that's closer to the national average, probably not quite at, but significantly better than what they originally proposed. And, Madam Chair, one thing that I was going to suggest is that if a number of legislators have contacted EPA and the Office of Management and Budget and urged them to adopt a more stringent rule that protects us here in the Northwest. And if you wanted to weigh in on that, I'd be happy to help provide some wording or share with you some letters that other federal and state legislators have sent to EPA. There's not a lot of time left. The rule's supposed to be finalized, I think, February 9th.
Okay, thank you.
On the right side of this chart, we're showing gasoline vapor recovery. This picture shows a gasoline tank that is filling up, or a gasoline truck that's filling up the underground storage tank at a gasoline station. And you can see that without vapor recovery, the vapors that are above the liquid level in the tank would be forced out the pipe and come out the roof of the gas station. With vapor recovery, the vapors go back into the truck, and they're balanced, and then the truck takes them back to the tank, and the vapors are never released into the environment. This is a relatively small strategy compared to reducing the benzene and gasoline, but it is something we can do here in the state, and our Environmental Quality Commission is looking very seriously at adopting a regulation to require statewide vapor recovery. We're also working with the Oregon Petroleum Association to develop a voluntary program. This is looking at diesel emissions. The good news here is that EPA on a national level has required new diesel engines to be cleaner and cleaner. So if you look in 1988, the level of emissions that a diesel truck could have, and that got progressively lower and lower until now. In 2007, the tiny little red box at the bottom represents the emissions today. So huge progress in trucks starting in 2007 this year. And in 2010, we'll have similar progress happening in some of those non-road engines like construction equipment that I showed you. The issue is that it will take a long time for us to get the benefit from this. And this chart shows the cancer risk in Oregon declining over time. But by 2026, we're still five times over the health benchmark for cancer risk from diesel particulate emissions just by implementing the federal program. So what we need to do to bring our risk down is to get some of the existing diesel engines that we have in Oregon, reduce those and retrofit them with emission-controlled equipment, which is now available, and bring their emissions down to levels closer to the new trucks. So that's kind of what our focus is there. And just wrapping up, here's our two bills, and you have fact sheets at the back of your handout on each of these two bills. HeatSmart is focused on changing out the uncertified wood stoves and replacing them with certified stoves or other cleaner forms of heat. And there's two ways we do that. The first is by creating a wood stove replacement fund. And that fund would be used to help low-income individuals as well as others with essentially a subsidy or an incentive for them to remove their old uncertified wood stove and replace it with a cleaner heating unit. We would target this grant program towards those areas that are close to the federal standards so that we'd be getting immediate benefit in those places where the air quality is the worst. Then HeatSmart also has another provision that's sort of a longer-term approach, in that it requires removal of uncertified wood stoves upon sale of a home. So when the real estate turns over, the uncertified stove is removed, and over a longer period of time, we'll eventually replace all of the uncertified stoves with certified stoves or other cleaner heating devices. The city of Bend pioneered this approach about 10 years ago. They've replaced most of their wood stoves. Just recently, the city of Jacksonville and a number of other local governments in Jackson County have adopted the Bend Ordinance. So we now have a movement going, and this bill would expand that to be a statewide provision. In addition, HeatSmart closes a number of loopholes that are in the federal wood stove certification program. And I've just illustrated one here with this picture. That's an outside wood-fired boiler. And it's used to heat water, which is then used to heat a home or to heat the water inside a home. It's a very inefficient way of heating water because the process of heat exchange between the water and this large outside wood-fired boiler causes the combustion temperature to be so low that we don't get good combustion and we get a lot of smoke. There's no federal standard for this type of equipment. And it's become a huge problem back east. My colleagues in Vermont tell me that they're being inundated with these things. And we are starting to see them now in Oregon. So the idea is not to prohibit them, but to give, this bill would give the Environmental Quality Commission the authority to set standards for them so that we'd require them to be clean like the other types of wood stoves and address a number of other loopholes in the federal law. And finally, the clean diesel bill would help us to retrofit those existing diesel engines. Remember the large legacy fleet of diesel engines built before 2007. It's a combination of a fund that can be used for grants or loans to retrofit, rebuild, or scrap diesel engines or reduce diesel truck idling. Also a diesel engine tax credit that would incentivize private investment in retrofitting diesel engines. And a clean school bus fund that's particularly targeted at helping the schools compete for federal grants. There's a lot of federal grant dollars out there for retrofitting school buses, and the more local match you can bring to the table, the more successful you'll be in competing for those federal dollars. And finally, the clean diesel bill includes incentives for fleet operators to buy new diesel trucks, because remember, we want them to buy the 2007 and newer trucks. It's likely that there'll be a drop in sales for a few years because of the new standards going into effect, and we want to kind of, at least for the first few years of the new standards, encourage people to buy those new trucks. And Madam Chair, with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you so much. Just I will have time for about one question, but I just want to mention, colleagues, that we will be hearing more in this committee on the clean diesel bill, and we probably will be having hearings on that shortly. So make sure you read the fact sheet, and we'll have more chance to discuss it. Representative Jensen?
Very simple question, right?
Use the mic so we can hear you.
Bump your mic.
Very simple question. We didn't get any discussion from you regarding what effect biodiesel would have on this if at some 10, 15, 5, whatever percentage, what the relationship would be. And I think that's probably a very important topic for us to be discussing.
An excellent question, Representative, given that our next hearing will be on biofuels bill and also the low sulfur diesel. Maybe you can talk about both of those really quickly and the impact that would have on possibly reducing air emissions.
Madam Chair, I would rather hear that information, though, from DEQ than from perhaps the producers or the vested interests in biodiesel.
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, just really quickly, biodiesel has lower, will overall have lower emissions than petroleum diesel. It will have lower particulate emissions and generates less net greenhouse gas emissions. It's as the chair mentioned, low sulfur diesel fuel is critical for this new technology to work. These catalytic converters that are on the diesel particulate traps, it's very similar to when we had for gasoline powered passenger vehicles, we had to get the lead out of gasoline for the catalytic converters to work. With diesel trucks, we have to get the sulfur out of the diesel for these particulate traps to work properly. So the biodiesel meets the low sulfur requirements. It won't result in the dramatic reductions in particulate emissions, though, that we get from installing the after treatment, the particulate filter. So we need to do them in combination, but they're a great combination. And so there's no conflict at all between the goals of expanding biofuels and also having clean diesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And unless there's some other burning questions, I think we're going to adjourn. And just a reminder to the committee that we will be meeting not here, but in hearing room A. Did you have a burning?
It is burning.
He's burning. So I will let my vice chair have the last question.
Thank
and then
you, Madam
we'll
Chair.
Adjourn.
And yeah. Andy, you really don't need to respond to this, but on these two pie charts, the sources of benzene and sources of fine particulate, and this is a burning question, both state that they exclude wildfires. And I'd like to see that the state, the DEQ, include that. I believe that you do have that information from your monitoring data. And those of us in a phenomenon that's particularly acute on the east side spend weeks, if not months, in smoke-filled skies because of these wildfires. And I think they're a huge problem, and I'd like to see that information on these pie charts in the future.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming today, Andy, and we'll look forward to seeing you in the future. And thank you. And the House Committee on Energy and Environment will adjourn.